How do we help clients experience growth when a trusted family member is the perpetrator of their trauma? Dr. Marsha Linehan knows very well the deeply painful struggle of clients who suffer this kind of extreme betrayal. But Marsha sometimes helps clients move past the unforgivable by suggesting the unimaginable.
I've had a lot of clients who basically were sexually hurt by their parents. Generally, obviously, their fathers for the most part. I mean, for every part. So what I have done, and often not only did the parents do it, but sometimes their siblings knew about it, and their siblings somewhat blamed them. So for the whole thing, as if somehow they could have kept it from happening. All right. So my own approach to the entire field of this is that particularly when your parents have done it, and that's been most of the cases I've had, where parents somehow were involved in this whole thing. And it's either the father did it, or the father did it and the mother knew about it and didn't do anything. So those are the two most common things. Now I have another client where the mother actually did it by being a drug addict and selling the daughter to people who raped her. So that particular case, not the one I'm going to talk about since I'm in the middle of it right now. I'm going to talk about the others. My own belief has always been that you are better off loving your parents than hating them. And so mainly because you've got their biology, if nothing else. You know, they are who you came from. And therefore, loving them in some way makes more sense than hating them. But I'm not particularly in favor of ever telling people they should forgive somebody else. Okay, so I'm not in favor of that. But I am in favor of, in effect, finding a way to still love them. And if I had to talk about growth in my own clients, I would say that the main growth has come from finding a way to understand, not necessarily approve or anything, but to understand what happened to their parents and how a parent could possibly have done that to them. And so I spend a fair amount of time with my clients on, let's talk about what could have happened.
Marsha makes an important distinction that I want to reiterate. When we ask a client to love someone who they might have every reason to hate, that's not the same as asking them to forgive that person. Instead, we're looking at ways to help the client understand what could have happened to make that person do what they did. Now, when we look at these extreme situations in terms of growth, progress can often be measured in very stark terms.
For example, I have one client, her father literally raped her every day after school before they went to dinner upstairs. So she was downstairs. She would meet with her dad downstairs at home. He would rape her. Then they'd go to breakfast. Then they'd go to dinner upstairs. Okay. So the question is, what's in her best interest given that? So we did the exposure therapy with me basically working with her. And getting her to do that almost always takes a really long time. So the growth that you get there, if nothing else, is that you're capable of extreme pain without trying to kill yourself. And for many of our clients, that's brand new. The idea that they could actually go through something and not kill themselves is a big deal. So with this particular client, it took a long time to get her to agree to exposure. And I imitated her father by getting her to sit in the chair and me standing on something really tall and then moving her through exposure. But my main problem, issue with her was to try to get her so that she could go to her father's home for Christmas, which it was the whole family went, and to also get her to relate to her sisters again, once again in her life. And her sisters, I would not say were terribly supportive of what had happened to her, because it hadn't happened to anybody else in the family, just to her. And so so my approach was not only to do the exposure, which we did, but then to talk to her about, how about if you tell your sisters and talk to your sister. That was also very difficult for her, because talking to her sisters was very difficult. And she had not really talked to her. It's as if her sisters knew about it, but nobody had ever talked about it. So I said, you know, if you're going to have sisters, you're better off having sisters that you can relate to. So you need sooner or later to talk to them. So that was the next thing she did. And then it was, and I tell all my clients, you're better off loving your parents than not loving your parents. You know, you go through a whole lifeline here, and you're going to be better off if we can figure out a way for you to still love your parents without necessarily approving of anything they did. So with her, it was both her father and her mother. So what we did with that one was we had the father come in. Now, the issue was whether the father was going to admit they had done it or not. I think had he not been willing to accept that he had done it, it would have been extraordinarily harmful for my client.
Marcia had separately spoken to both the client's father and her mother. She explained the situation to them and her client's desire to bring the family back together. But there was still one major hurdle. That hurdle was this: could the father admit to what he had done? And beyond that, could the mother acknowledge what her husband had done? Marcia went through many more sessions, some with the client and some with the parents. And one particular session, Marcia picked up on something that helped give her client some new perspective.
What happened that made it very clear to me that something had also probably happened to Dad was that one time Dad was raping my client and the grandmother walked into the room, saw the whole thing, walked right by it, and went to the other room. So I said to the client, I said, doesn't this tell you something about your father, probably? I mean, don't you think it's a little weird that the grandmother would have seen this and not said anything about it? Doesn't that make you think that maybe all of this also happened to your dad? So I wasn't sure about that, but basically I sold her on the idea that it's possible her dad also was traumatized at some point in the game, and that was part of what had happened to him too. Okay. So what happened was I taught her all the exposure. Now, the problem was when she used to get raped all the time, they would be playing games down in the basement where, you know, they'd be playing sorts of games that you can go and play anywhere. And so what happened was I made her also practice all of this stuff, all these games, all this stuff, making the same noises. Okay, so she got pretty much through that. We brought the parents, and then the issue was, if you're really going to be part of this family and it's Christmas and they're having a Christmas party for the family, do you want to go? And so she did, and we practiced a lot of that, and everything was really fine. And she walks in and she hears her siblings in the basement playing the same game. So she hears those things. So, of course, she immediately goes backwards. And so she came back, and I said, okay, we got to practice more. She said, you mean I got to go do this more? I said, right, we got to go do it more. We got to get you so you can hear this stuff and not get so upset. So finally, the parents have come in. They admitted what they'd done. I had told her all along, we're not talking about forgiveness. If you want to do forgiveness, it's fine with me, but you don't have to forgive. What you have to do is understand that what happened. And so ultimately, she ended up being able to go to things with her family. Not like there was ever any approval for what had happened. And the exposure treatment had brought the post-traumatic stress all the way down, which it ordinarily does if you do it correctly. So that wasn't really a problem. So the growth here was that she was able to get a relationship back with her sisters who had never supported her. But she got them more, she was able to talk to them such that their relationships got better. And she ended up not completely destroying her parents, which I considered a big success personally. And she got a job and quit trying to kill herself. And the treatment worked very well.
So in this particular case, we can see how post-traumatic growth can happen, even without forgiveness. Marcia's client experienced growth and was able to begin to turn around parts of her life that had been so badly damaged by trauma. The client's relationship with her sisters improved. And that matters because if you recall what Dr. Sue Johnson talked about in Module 3, the quality of someone's relationships is a critical factor in healing and growth. Now, for some additional thoughts on Marcia's approach, let's visit again with Dr. Ron Siegel and Dr. Kelly McGonigal.
I thought that this was really bold on Marcia's part to put forward her thoughts about this. And I bet there's some controversy around this, and I expect that there is. She was pointing out that a lot of times after trauma, victims will cut off contact, you know, even if the trauma is coming from a family member or friend or the like. And she said that she's got a pretty strong bias against this, a pretty strong bias to try to maintain contact, and particularly with parents, I think she said. And I really appreciated her naming this because I noticed in my own clinical work that I actually share that that bias. I have a patient of mine who had a very narcissistic father, was humiliated a lot as a child, and currently is engaged with his father intermittently, but his dad gets engaged in all sorts of status-related antics, you know, all sorts of things that, well, you know, you've got to visit me before I visit you, or, who's written more, and will also often be cold and rejecting, and it's very hard for my patient, and his impulse is to just, you know, I don't need this, you know, enough. And he's very tempted to cut off contact, both to alleviate the pain and to be able to express, I'll show him, you know, this is what he'll get. I'll reject him. And I'm always interested in seeing my own bias around this, because like Marcia, I have this bias of, I'm not sure that's the best, that's going to be best for your own growth and development here. And I wonder, you know, what forms our biases? I know for me, you know, I come from a family of origin, which certainly has its dysfunctions, but they seem like somehow you can muddle through them. And even if they're sometimes painful, it feels like it's a lot better to continue with something that's a bit dysfunctional than it would be to break off contact. And it has always seemed to me that maturity in relationships involves seeing the good and the bad in the other. And even if there's a lot of bad, well, and I'm not saying there is in my family in particular, but even if there is a lot of bad, well, you know, they're family. And I think of us growing up evolutionarily in bands of 25 to 50. And, you know, you couldn't really cut off contact if you're living with the same 25 to 50 primates your whole life. And that, you know, figuring out a way to tolerate the discomfort and stay connected seems important. But then again, for some people, it really is outside their zone of tolerance and it feels like too much. And they just, you know, they just have to cut off contact. So it got me just musing about this whole topic, which I think is quite complex. You know, othering the other usually isn't a good idea. It usually involves projecting split off parts of ourselves onto the other. And that's usually part of the process of cutting off contact, and certainly learning to see the disavowed things we don't like in the other, to be able to see them in ourselves is an important part of post-traumatic growth. You know, oh, I see, I'm kind of like my father in some ways, even though I really don't like those parts. But then I started thinking, well, you know, the other pathway of actually cutting off the contact, maybe you can continue to do the post-traumatic growth, if you will, with the interjected other, with the image of the other in your heart and mind, and talk to them and work with them without actually having the contact. So I'm sorry if I'm a little rambling here. I was left firmly in the camp of uncertainty that this is a really important decision. Marcia has her bias. I kind of share her bias, but it's a bias, and it's probably good to consider both sides of this.
Yeah, I mean, I'll weigh in just from anecdotal, my own experience in talking with people who've survived childhood abuse. It is perfect. People are perfectly capable of experiencing post-traumatic growth after completely cutting themselves off from the abuser and whole swaths of the family. I think that it would be a mistake to think that post-traumatic growth requires healing a relationship. There are a lot of ways that one can can change themselves or their lives or the world in ways that they value that don't require fixing or coming to terms with some that particular relationship in the past, even though I deeply appreciated the case that Marcia shared.
I think this is a little bit like what you see among clinicians when a client or patient is considering divorce. You know, clinicians that have gotten divorced and where that was they retrospectively think that was a really good thing in their life, their threshold for getting divorced is at a somewhat different place than people who've toughed it out and think that that was a good decision to make. So, I think we have a lot of opportunities for bias because both are clearly quite true that there's value to, it could be valuable to stay connected and it could work out quite well to stop being connected.
And knowing how much ambivalence every person is likely to have no matter what decision they're making, and finding a way to support their autonomy and feel like they've made a powerful choice, that is right, their choice, and they're making it as part of the healing process.
That was a helpful way to look at the important factor of connection and how it relates to post-traumatic growth. So now I want to circle back and talk a little bit more about forgiveness. If you remember, Marcia Linehan focused her client more toward understanding and love instead of forgiveness. This plays into a bigger discussion on what we choose to focus on in our interventions. These choices can make the difference in how our clients respond to post-traumatic growth. A little later in the program, we'll get much deeper into this with Drs. Michael Yapko and Scott Miller. But getting back to the idea of forgiveness, Dr. Rick Hansen looked at how to approach this ideas with clients. Rick says there are two levels to forgiveness that we might want to keep in mind when it comes to post-traumatic growth.
First, I want to say I think there ought to be the equivalent of a Nobel Prize in psychology, and I think Marcia Linehan deserves one of them. So that said, I suspect she would agree with this point, that I think it's important to be careful about being overly prescriptive or narrow in terms of laying out the path to healing. I think people have different paths and they're different paths that twine together for different people in different combinations. All that said, the distinction between love and forgiveness, I thought was really quite powerful. And it's been very useful for me in working with people who've been traumatized to draw on some of the work of Fred Luskin, who's developed research on forgiveness, as you know. And my kind of simplistic takeaway from a lot of what Fred has done is to think of two levels of forgiveness. And for me, there's a distinction. One is the classic level of full pardon, forgiveness. You wipe the slate clean. You commute the sentence. You start over. You find love in your heart for that person. It's kind of a full pardon. You're willing to start anew. Maybe the wheels of justice still need to turn, but you're not pursuing punishment yourself. Right? But then there's this second level of forgiveness where it's not that you give the person a full pardon and you may never want to see that person again, but at least as far as your own mind is concerned, you've laid down that burden. You're not carrying that hot coal around any longer in your hand, and you're not flinging it at the other person in a vengeful, retributive, case-making, prosecutorial way. And knowing that there is this possibility, I call it disentangled forgiveness. It's not a full pardon, but you're disentangling yourself from the situation, a lot based on an understanding, as Marcia was speaking to, of the past that led to the past, of that other person, of the many causes in their own life, their parents' parents, their social class, gender socialization, life events, that led them to do what they did as part of a larger, impersonal, vast network of causes. You know, that kind of understanding can help move a person to that sort of disentangled forgiveness. And the bottom line on all that, I've known people who I've tried to get them to love their parents, and their bottom line authentically is, no, I don't love them. I didn't get love from them. I don't have love for them, but I'm at peace with them. I wish them well. I'll be sorry if bad things were to happen to them. I have compassion for them, and I never need to talk with them again for the rest of my life, and I'm okay with that. And I think that was a wake-up call for me as a young therapist to realize that was actually healthy adaptive coping for that particular person. But clearly, that person had gotten to the kind of disentangled forgiveness that I'm talking about, which is, if you think of it, most fundamentally an expression of an inner freedom. The thing that's most central to the nature of trauma is entrapment and loss of freedom of action. So reclaiming as much freedom of action as possible, if only inside our own minds, in how we look at things, is a real piece of the puzzle for me in walking away from the train wreck and living our life, you know, better and more fully.
That ability, expressing their inner freedom, that ability can be a game changer for many clients. And it can be the spark that our clients need to start growing after their traumatic experience. In the next module, we'll look at how to promote growth in our clients even after trauma has severely altered their sense of the world. I'll see you there.